Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview, where our guest today is Amanda Eyre Ward, and we're going to be talking about her latest novel, The Lifeguards. Now, Amanda was a guest for her last book, The Jet Setters, which, like The Lifeguards, was a Betzon selection. I absolutely love both of these books. She was one of our last guests when we were in the office in New York before the pandemic. And, oh, just, you know, covers do matter. On a cold winter day a couple of weeks ago, I pulled this one from the shelves just because of the cover. That beautiful water, the trees, those little floaty things in the pool, in the water, I was already due. So I had warm summer thoughts. So welcome back, Amanda. So glad you wrote this book and that you're here with us.
Thank you so much. I think my event with you in March 2020 or February even was one of my last events as well. And then I just had a big book release last night in Austin, and it was so joyful to be back out in the world. If only temporarily, I'll take it. So I actually had cookies made that looked like these little floats and things like that.
I love it. I love it. So tell us about The Lifeguards, which I really did tear through in a day. I know it took you a lot longer to write that, but I'm telling you, I just sat down and was like, okay, I just put it down as a done. Great.
Well, that means a lot to me because it was hard to figure out. You know, The Jet Setters was really a character-based novel without a, you know, crime of any type except against the heart. But The Lifeguards from the beginning was almost a domestic suspense, I started calling it, because it's a crime thriller, I guess. And it has a cop, Salvatore, sexy Salvatore, but it really is about the characters as well. So it was fun to put together and really go into these women's lives. And during the pandemic, I was in Colorado and really missing Austin. So Austin became a main character, and it's where I live. And so I see The Lifeguards really as a love letter to Austin. It's three Austin moms who are best friends drinking margaritas together one night, when their three 15-year-old sons, who are lifeguards, bike home and come inside and say something terrible has happened. And it's that they've found a body on the greenbelt near their house, and the story starts there.
And from there, we've got these women who, okay, so what we all know is if you have children, you're friends of the women who are the mothers who are the mothers of your children. That's it.
Yes.
You end up as a group. I always think if I didn't have children, how would I have met so many more people? Like it wouldn't have been happening. So tell us about these women, because they're three very different women in a lot of ways, but they're bonded because of their boys.
Yes. I mean, they met in a prenatal yoga class when they were all pregnant with these 15-year-old boys. So you have Whitney, who's a real estate titan now. And when they all met, they didn't have their big careers yet. So Whitney is a real estate agent in Austin, and she specializes in doomsday properties, which actually have started to be a thing, especially in the outskirts of Austin, where very wealthy people are buying houses that have underground bunkers or eye retina scanners, or apparently some plan to come from Silicon Valley to the outskirts of Austin, the Hill Country, where they'll hole up anyway. So I just had fun kind of imagining what these houses could be. And Whitney is the realtor showing these guys around, because most of them seem to be guys in our influx in Austin of tech workers. Anyway, and then Annette works at a daycare. She is a first generation Mexican American. She's just Mexican and then becomes an American over the course of the novel. She's absolutely beautiful basketball star. And she has married a wealthy white guy from Midland, Texas, Lewis. And then the main character to me, the only first person character, is Liza, named after my sister, actually. And she is a single mom and she adores her son, Charlie, but she won't tell him who his father is. So she has secrets that she wants to protect. And she's sort of on the outskirts. She rents her house. She wants to fit in, but she doesn't have the financial security to really fit in. So she's a little too desperate.
Yeah. And Whitney is a little bit too overprotective of her too. Whitney is always, oh, I'll take care of you. It's like her pet project. She's her pet project. And she wants to make sure, but she could never be Whitney. She doesn't want her to ever become Whitney. She wants her to stay in her place, but still make her feel good. Am I right?
She'll buy her the same lipstick or fancy cat eye glasses from the fancy shop here. But she likes having an acolyte, you know. Mm-hmm. She likes having Liza follow her around and worship her, for sure. Yeah.
I loved when Whitney talks about the real estate in New Zealand, because everybody wants to go there. And it was a very interesting look at what real estate is like in Austin right now. And I have a friend who lives down there, and she said the house next door to her, somebody, it was a perfectly nice house. They knocked it down and they're building like this huge thing on it. And she said, that's basically what's happening in Austin right now. People are moving in and doing over.
Yeah. Also, it's a lot of people. Two people on my street on either side are from Williamsburg. It's like the next stop out is South Austin. Yeah. You go farther out than Williamsburg, then maybe, you know, Queens, I don't know, and then Austin. That was the fun part. That was, you know, the last 10 years have been a lot of New Yorkers, including myself, but now it's starting to be people who are tearing down the houses and changing the downtown. And it is a crazy world. It's a crazy world. And that's why it was fun to have Whitney's job, because I could peek into it. Right. And I'm sort of an obsessive house watcher anyway. I've lived in this house for 10 years, but I love peeking around and seeing what's for sale. And I have friends who are realtors, so it was very fun.
Yeah, there was a house by us that had a pool inside that I actually went and looked at. We're not going to move into it, but I really loved, like, how did they do the pool inside? And they have like floats around and stuff. I said, oh, this is so cool. I got home and I'm like, how many people are going to want that though? How long is that going to stay on the market, even in a hot market? It was really fun. But it was on market longer than the other houses on either side of it. But it did sell. It did sell. Yeah. And it did sell at a good price. But it's like, that was a harder one to find the right buyer for. But also, we're seeing in the market here right now, not much is on the market and people still want to move. So we drove past a couple of weeks ago, like where there was an open house, and literally there were cars up and down the block. And we were like, is somebody having a party? And they go, no, they're going to look at that one house. And I was
my gosh,
it's really changed. It's really, really changed.
You know, my house that I'm sitting in right now sat on the market for a little while because of this space. That's my office. It's this big upstairs space. It didn't have a bookshelf till I moved in, but I think people have asked me, oh, you bought that house on Ray Dell. What are you doing in the upstairs? Do you do yoga? Or the architect had her office here. And I said, well, actually, I thought I would write novels, but then I moved into a little closet where I feel more comfortable. I do interviews here.
I interview here, and that's what I did. That's very funny. Well, you know, last year we said the big one was, thank God we didn't downsize.
Oh my gosh.
Need every inch of space you possibly could have in your house.
It's the truth. I had 3 kids at home, one of whom would make ramen at 10 in the morning, and it was just the smell of ramen and coffee. Oh, I'm so thankful to be back.
Yes, it's like, okay, school, go. It's a good thing. School's good.
It's the best.
Did one of the moms come to you first, and were there always 3? Or did you ever think about more or less? Or,
you know, I did think about more, and that's when I started incorporating the listserv. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's really funny. Random House has ads in Nextdoor for this book right now, because I start going into the neighborhood next door and how that commentary plays in. That was during the pandemic, because we were all so lonely that I certainly was like oversharing on various neighborhood boards. So that was the way that I brought in other characters. And I think the 3 main characters were always who they were. I changed some of the names around a little bit because my other sister, Sarah, said, why don't you name a character after me? So I named Whitney Sarah, but it just didn't feel right. So I think my next book will have a Sarah. But anyway, so I changed their names, but they were always who they were to me. I saw them very clearly. I saw how they were different. And how Annette talks about the wolf pack, you know, what their pecking order would be, who's the alpha. I don't see that as much with my friends, but our relationships have changed as the children have gotten older. You know, sometimes our kids have nothing in common anymore. They don't want to go spend the weekend together, or they've made parenting decisions that are totally different to my parenting decisions. My son is dyslexic and so went to a private school. And, you know, changed a lot of his friends. So I also changed a lot of my friends. It's so strange. And especially when you live in the same place, as I think you do, every park has like 10 Amandas that I remember. You know, I pull up and I think, oh, I remember having a toddler here. I remember going to ACL with my 18-year-old here. So it's all those different selves and how they connected and had friends and made a life all on top of each other in the present is what I wanted to explore.
Yeah. And it's really funny because you think about the things you did on Saturday mornings that you had to be here. You have to go do this. And then it goes away. It's like, wait a second. How did I do that all that time? I still don't have time. How did I?
I am still in the middle of it. I have a 10-year-old. So I just got back from Girl Scout camp the night before my event at Book People. And that was crazy. And so, yeah, I have two who can't drive and one who can, thank goodness. Right. But he's going to college and people say, oh, aren't you just so upset? And to be honest, no, I'm thrilled that he's going and we are overwhelmed. Like too many dishes, too many carpools. But yeah, I know that's another thing that the book is exploring for me, that you, when you have a child, as you know, you are sort of forced to become a different kind of person and then they leave you. And who are you? You know, you've been sort of hammered into a mother and then what, you know, who do you become after that? So that's because all the moms in the lifeguards have kids who are 15 and they don't have any younger kids. So they are questioning that, you know, who are they going to become next?
What are we going to do next? You know, I'm betting that Liza was the easiest one for you to write. Was she the easiest? Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to say she's me. And I said at the Book People reading, I was sort of caught off guard and asked which was me. And I said, Liza's definitely the one who's like me. And there's my husband going, you're not a single mom. What are you talking about? So I'm not a single mom, but my mom was. And so a lot of her feelings I remember from growing up. I grew up in a New York suburb where it wasn't really comfortable for everyone to invite a single mom. She had to resign from the golf club because you're not allowed to be a member when you're single. And so it was kind of strange growing up that way. And I was exploring a lot of that with Liza.
Yeah. It's like, and there are secrets. Liza's got secrets. And it's interesting to see how those secrets get handled in the book. You know, three is such a tough number in friendships and how they survive together is really, really good. And I thought there was something about that three. It was like, you know, it's a triangle, which is like, you know, oh, it's the steadiest way to be. But by the same token, there's always somebody who'd be on the outs. And instead, these three really bonded over their children. And I think that's what held the three together. That's what it was
doing. Absolutely. And, you know, that's what they, you know, that's why it was so devastating when this crime occurs and they have to kind of question not just what would I do to protect my child and would I value my friendships, but also what is my child capable of? Mm-hmm. That was a tough question for all of them. Because some of them are like, oh, I know my son, they would never do this. And then some of them are thinking, maybe I don't. And that's a terrifying thought.
And to be sitting there saying, we need your child's DNA. And you're like, you need what? Like, what do you have to do? What do you think my child did? It was one of those moments where, and these mothers who usually head out for margaritas and they just have fun with their own. And I love all the different ways they pack their margaritas together to take. Like,
if they go for a dog walk.
Go for their dog walks. Yeah, I love that. But now
and
I know you can
meet at the fanciest listing that week with margaritas. Yeah.
But I know you've been sober for a while. And as a result, you even wrote a book about that. Was it fun to write those pages though, of like, you know, thinking of the moms with their margaritas and going out on the dog trail, you know?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I got sober 6 years ago. So that was a lot of years as a mom, you know, 12 years of being a mom and drinking. So I had a lot to rely on. And I still go out with my friends who drink margaritas and just bring seltzer and have just as much fun, if not more so. But I do go home a little earlier and remember everything I've said. But yeah, it was definitely exploring those years with my friends. When I did my reading at Book People, they were all right there. So it was so funny to see them. And you know, we had a lot of fun. And that the fun that we're having is changing in many ways, not just drinking or not drinking because we just can't keep it up anymore. But also, you know, what we're going to do together, if we're going to go to an art opening, you know, if we're not at the soccer game anymore together, where are we going to be? And I think a lot of what I value is my friendships because this time is coming where our role as a mother is diminishing, you know, at least on a daily basis. It's important to still have those friends. Yeah. And it's hard to keep them up. It's hard to give them a call or go for a walk. In fact, I've been finding myself in the last month or so calling people, which I normally hate to do. But we text, and we're not having that time in the carpool line or at the soccer field that we used to have. So I just miss talking to people.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny you say that because I'll pick up the phone sometimes and I'll call an author that we're working with, or I'll call instead of just doing emails back and forth, because you want to just have a conversation.
Yeah.
I've actually done this crazy thing this year that I've been challenging myself to have 3 calls with people in the industry each week and just call people and say, what's going on? And I mark it in green on my calendar because that means I did it that week. Like I did what I'm supposed to do. But I'm trying to hold myself accountable because there's so many not run into people that you used to do and know what was going on. So it's
well,
funny.
I love your, you know, like the Instagram lives are so fantastic because you're sitting there. I was personally like feeling a little bit lonely and then I'm like, oh, it's a live. Like there are some friends right there. And you can be a part of the conversation, which is really not, you know, or just watch it. The perfect introvert party. You can stay in
perfect
your
thing
and periodically give a thumbs up and just listen.
Or throw a little heart. That. Yeah.
I do love that.
So let's talk about the boys that are lifeguards. So there are 3 boys that are the lifeguards. They're 15 years old, which is an interesting age too, because some are more mature than others. Some have their voices are deeper, some are not. And so you've got these 3 boys that are all at different phases of their being 15.
Yeah. I mean, when I wrote the book, my 18-year-old was 15 when I started it. And now I have a 15-year-old again. And it's funny to even remember what it was like because my 18-year-old is sort of a normal conversationalist now. He's nice, he's happy. And 15 is a very, you're kind of making your own secret life, I think. All of them are. But what the book was inspired when I was at my mom's at one summer and my 15-year-old son was here in Austin with his dad and another friend. And one of the moms called me and said, oh, I'm in the emergency room because, you know, the boys were jumping off the cliffs on the greenbelt and one of them got hurt, not my son. But I said, they were what? You know, I didn't know that. And she said, oh, they've been doing it all summer. I didn't know that. And it was the first time I realized he has a whole life that has nothing to do with me, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't think he was keeping it secret from me. It's just, I was non-issue. Honestly, I wasn't physically there and he was just doing what he wanted to do. And so it was a dual realization because first of all, I saw that he was apart from me, had his own life and his own love and secrets. And the other part was realizing I am no longer 15 because I remember that age and I remember feeling fully realized. And you know, my adult life, I went to boarding school when I was 14. I never lived at home again. And so to realize, oh, well, I'm no longer that age, you know, it was a lot of emotions going on.
Really big going on. So which of the boys was your favorite to write? We've got the 3 boys. Was there one that was it Charlie or was it?
Well, Charlie, Liza's son, is the sweetest. He reminds me the most of my son. Sorry, my schnauzers are hanging out in the background. And Annette's son, Bobcat, was the most fun because he's trouble. You think he's trouble.
Yeah.
And Xavier, I just honestly was worried about from the beginning. And I did a little thing on Instagram where I put who I would put as the actors. And I found this photo of Timothy Chalamet, who I adore. And he's dressed as a big buff lifeguard. So I put him for Bobcat. Like, he's the guy. He's the kind of thug, but with a heart of gold. They're all such good guys.
They are. And the way they end up in this circumstance is... Yeah. Oh gosh, now what are we going to do? And who's involved with what and whatever. And then we have Roma. Roma is a very interesting character. She is so tough and she is so angry in many ways, cunning in other ways, manipulative in other ways. And maybe the best thing to say is she dresses well, like other than
dresses
that.
Dresses well. She also, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but there is a diagnosis that is, you basically don't have empathy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be the most terrifying thing I could imagine, to have a child, you know, because you raise your child hoping to give them empathy. And sometimes I feel like maybe I've raised my kids to have too much empathy in the current world, especially if it's going to be run by certain political parties without empathy. But it's a psychological condition to not, to literally be unable to access empathy for others. And it just fascinated me psychologically. And so I don't know, did you see the movie about the climber, Alex Honnold?
Yes.
So he has, you know, he doesn't have a problem with empathy, but he climbs in these almost suicidal ways. And he talks about how he only feels alive when he's doing that. And they'd give him a brain scan. Do you remember? And he's basically depressed when he's not in absolute peril.
Right.
And that's what happens with some of these kids, that if they're not doing awful things, they're depressed. So in order to sort of boost their mood, they do horrific things. So
to get the endorphins,
it's a real condition. And it's just unbelievable and fascinating. And so, of course, I thought, what would the mother feel like?
Mm-hmm. Where would she be coming into the whole thing? I kept thinking about the HBO show, The White Lotus, that was set in Hawaii.
Yes. And the water,
like they had the brother go sleep in the other room on the floor. It's like they're in this beautiful suite. And she's like, you go there. You go like sleep there. The kid goes and sleeps on the beach. And when you thought, I thought of that the whole time. And she wasn't sort of that complete character, but just the way, no empathy for her brother whatsoever.
That's perfect, because actually I wrote this way before I saw White Lotus. But of course, when they go to New Zealand, it's a very similar layout of the hotel room, now that you pointed out. Yeah. And I have never been to New Zealand, but I did a ton of research on what the realtor would be selling there. Because that, of course, so if they're building these doomsday bunkers around Austin, they've already been building them in New Zealand. So I'd made a fictional place, but it's based on a real place that is basically a golf club. You can play once in your life and then you have to be a member. And it's supposed to be the most beautiful place in the world. And I watched videos and it is, but it's also extremely remote. And so the idea is that they're gonna just put up the gates at some point. It seemed funny when I started the book. Now it's like, oh my gosh, what is happening?
But what is happening? Like, what are, this is really the way people are thinking, especially extremely wealthy people who would have to have the right plane to get there. So, and it always
gets right. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of thought of how do we help keep this from happening? What do we, you know, it's not like Nelson Rockefeller building beautiful, you know, art, pieces of art and architecture to help the world. It is this every man for himself mentality. And that's a lot of what I was exploring. You know, they're the lifeguards. The moms are laser focused. My kid, my house. That's what I want to protect. And as in the book, there've been a few neighbors have built gates in my neighborhood, which had never had gates. I don't have gates. And there's a few houses that have been built with these huge gates. And it says a lot to me. In fact, another house in our neighborhood built a huge, beautiful house, giant walls around it. And then on the outside did no landscaping. It's just like dry dust for the, you know, where all the kids will walk to school. And I thought, with all your money, you couldn't plant or make a little path. It's like, we don't care. Outside of our walls. It looks like the border. It's just unbelievable. Every time my daughter comes home with muddy shoes from that yard, it just makes me so furious symbolically that they couldn't just put a little tree or some flowers.
Something, do something like that, but they don't have to see it, so it doesn't matter. But
right.
I have friends that have gates and they said the police and the fire have to have the combination to your gates. They have to be able to get in, because if not, like, is somebody going to be well enough to go hit the gate open? And I was like, that's something I never even thought about.
I mean, where my mom lives, there's a gate at the beginning. Outside Savannah, which I'm sure people would love to do here, but they can't. So it's confusing. And I think I just wanted to say something about it, honestly. So I hope that you can like turn the pages and laugh at the characters too, because it's hard. Life is hard right now. You know, I've written a lot of books exploring issues, but I also want to have fun.
Yeah, no, definitely have fun. Believe me, it was page turner. It's a complete page turner, because you don't know, first of all, you don't know a lot about the woman who's killed. Then you learn more about her. Then we're going to talk about next about the detective on the case who's got a lot of issues of his own.
Yes.
And he's got a lot going on in his life and he keeps bringing in babysitters and people to take care of his kids. And it's just, I mean, it's just going so badly for this guy. So let's talk about him.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I had a problem because I didn't know how to write a cop. I've never written a cop. This is my 10th book. And I have never had a point of view character. I've had doctors, lawyers, you know, people in prison, never a cop. So I really had to do a lot of research. And I spoke with homicide detectives and my friend Meg Gardner, who's a thriller writer, and other friends who are thriller writers, and read a bunch of autobiographies. There's a guy who Mindhunter was based on, and he has all these autobiographies. So I had to figure out, you know, what do they even do? What are the tools they use? What's in their car? What kind of car are they driving? I was constantly Googling, like, Do they wear the same clothes? You know, what do they wear? So that was really fun for me to have a whole new project. But yes, he has problems. I really do see him as Matthew McConaughey. He has not optioned the book, but I just wrote him that way because he's an Austin guy and he's a little bit seedy and, you know, sexy and kind of overwhelmed. So, yeah, so Salvatore, he had, his wife has died and he has two kids who are just running him around and he is a mess.
He's a mess. And at the same time, he's got this crime he's got to solve.
Yes.
And he keeps getting help on doing it, but then he has to worry about the kids. And then his son's not speaking to him about something. And it's just, and then you find out something else, which we're not going to give anything away, but like there's another liaison that ends up happening. So there's so many themes in this book. There's motherhood, privilege, money, longing, just to name a few. Is the motherhood the one you started with and then plunged into the others? Or was one of these other ones that, you know, I'll give them to get motherhood, privilege, money, longing, family. Was it one that started with?
I think all of mine are longing, to be honest. I think they all are. I think they all start with like, what is home and how could it be taken away from you? Which probably tells you more than you need to know about me. But I think because I'm so in love with Austin, my brain sometimes goes to, what if I lost Austin? And this is a character who wants to stay and is finding that it's really hard to stay. Mm-hmm. And circumstances are forcing her away from the one place she calls home. And I find that to be something that I worry about a lot. So even though I have no need to.
Yeah.
So I create, you know, reasons that she would have to worry about it. And I explore that longing for the place you belong, for safety.
Mm-hmm. The place that you are. It's funny, I was thinking of Jacqueline Michard's book, The Good Son, as I read this. I read it earlier this year and interviewed her. It's different in many ways because what it is a son who's coming out of prison. And like, he doesn't even remember the night the crime happened. And he comes home and everybody in the neighborhood hates him. So what you've got is everybody is buzzing about these boys that were out there that night. And everybody's buzzing about what was really going on. And it's like the head of hoppers of the neighborhood of trying to figure out like, what happened? How much do we know? How much don't we know? And I thought of that because it's something happens to your child and then you are then branded with whatever happened to your child as well. You're the mother, so-and-so. And I was thinking about that because whatever, if one of these boys, whatever happens with these boys, the mother is then going to be the mother of whatever happened. And I was thinking about that a lot.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. I would love to read that book. I think it's true because we all kind of have opinions about our neighbors and what we've heard that their kids have done. And, you know, in my friend group, we've had kids become famous. We've had kids get into a lot of trouble, you know, and it does sort of reflect on you, or you make it reflect on yourself for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have to sit there and say, she's seeing the kid with different eyes. And I think all these mothers are, wait, he's got to get his DNA. Wait, could he have done this? Could he have been involved in this? And it has to do a playthrough in their heads. And I thought that was really interesting because whether or not they did it, it's still, they have to play it through their heads of like, are they capable of this? How could they have done it?
And why? And also I thought I knew my son like my own, you know, arm, and they have secrets. Mm-hmm. They all do. Mm-hmm. And they should, but it feels very strange. I mean, you know, one of the things that shaped the plot is, and I wrote an essay for Crime Reads that they put up today, and it's about the Meryl Streep movie Before and After. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yes.
That's based on a novel too. I think Rose Ellen Brown maybe, but it's the doorbell rings and Meryl Streep opens the door and they say, "We're looking for your son. We think he murdered his girlfriend." And immediately the Meryl Streep character's like, absolutely not, you know, like, come on in. I'm sure there's no way. And the dad's like, you're not coming in. And he starts to go cover it up, you know? Yeah. So it's like these two and there's this scene where she says to him at one point, how could you believe that our son would do this? And his mind immediately goes to protecting.
Yes.
And she just can't even fathom it. And then of course the car is in the garage with blood in it and the son is gone. And it's just, but it's that how much it affects their relationship and their view of themselves. That's so amazing.
Yes. And even they've got the secret phone. Whitney's husband has the secret phone. They're like, I wish we could have a secret phone. Like we'd have to have a phone that can't be traced. And he goes, no, we're dialing from this phone. And you're just there. It's like what people do to themselves.
I had to make it work, and I don't want to give anything away, but that the husband would be an antagonist in her plan to fix the family. So mm-hmm. I thought, what would make that work? And it's him being so invested with their company that he didn't want anyone to be talking about it.
Mm-hmm. It's all
so
image.
So that she's forced to do other things. Yeah.
It's all about image, all about image. But I did like the town listserv, which was the Barton Hills Mamas. And I think that anybody who has, like, we have a Facebook page in our town, and it's really funny because people will move out here that have lived in the city, and they'll go, like, I think I saw a coyote in your backyard, in my backyard. They take a picture. My husband goes, that's a dog. Like, you know.
I just posted that a coyote followed me and my daughter to school 2 days ago, and people were like, good. They're fine. Don't worry. Because I thought, oh no, is this the apocalypse? But we live on a greenbelt and apparently they're down there. I thought it was pretty weird. I was pretty nervous.
Well, there was one day that there was a note that there was a black bear in the neighborhood. We have this big fence because I don't want the deer to eat the flowers. Believe me, but the fence was open one night and they like annihilated the backyard. You know,
so oh no.
Right? So this big fence up. And one day I look out the window and the fence, the bear is on the other side of the fence and it's big. And I just call my next door neighbor and go, it's headed your way. And she's like, are you kidding? And there are moments when you see this, like in your backyard, and you're just there like, okay, this is like really weird that there's this large bear lumbering around the backyard right now. You know?
Yeah, my daughter went to school in Colorado during the pandemic. We have a house in a little town and they shut down the school for a bear. The bear was lurking around the school. So they shut down and she said, it's so nice at home. There's always like bomb threats, but here it's just a bear.
It's just a bear coming out. And this is really funny because it's like somebody said, I saw a fox, bring your little dogs in. All small animals should come in tonight. And it's just the conversation. So when I was reading this one, and then there's always the person who's talking about something they're not supposed to do. And it was the Mary Kay medic person. And I am just laughing because there's always somebody brings something up. I don't know if I'm supposed to do this, but, and it's like,
well, and you know, it seems like a lot of the cosmetic selling people do get on those boards and they kind of are like, I'm concerned about the coyote, but here's this other thing. And that was really fun. That was the way I kind of tried to lighten the book up because I sold it as a pretty dark, creepy thriller. Yeah. But then when I was writing it, the world was dark and creepy and I wanted to have some fun and sunshine.
You definitely have fun in sunshine. Definitely there. Definitely there. Now I did love, like you live in Austin. So at the beginning, you've got this map of the green belt.
Isn't that the greatest?
It's the best. It's like, okay, guys, this is what the green belt looks like, you know, and it's so cool. So, okay, there's swimming holes. Do you have a favorite? Like, do you go to these places or do
you? Oh, yeah. I go almost every day down there and I walk my daughter. I can pick up my daughter. I can go through and pick her up at school.
Right.
So Gus Frew in the middle is where there, you can kind of see it actually in the map. There's a rope swing.
Right.
So we go there a lot. Barton Springs, of course, is the famous swimming hole in Austin. We live right near that. But Sculpture Falls is really fun to hike to. It's really magical. I mean, imagine if Central Park then went through the whole rest of the city and you can hike for 4 or 5 hours along there without coming up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And most people don't know that about Austin either. They really don't. And I actually just pitched a travel story where you go from the airport in 4 days and end up in West Austin. And I found hotels and restaurants along the way. So I said, you could fly into Austin, put your backpack on and come up to luxury hotels for 3 nights.
I love it.
And go back.
When I was there, I stayed at the Four Seasons. I remember that because I do like 5-star hotels.
And that's on the river. So that's
on the river. There was the river like on the other side. And I was like,
yeah, that beautiful lawn that goes down. And that's part of the Greenbelt.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was absolutely stunning. But I was like, okay, wait, this is Austin? You know, what's going on?
Yeah,
I've been down there, you know, since that conference. My friend owns Yard Dog, the art gallery down there.
That's fantastic. That's right near me. Yeah, wow.
We worked together at Mademoiselle Magazine. Jan and I worked together and she's now the chief brand officer for South by Southwest. So it's really fun.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Did you know my mom worked for Mademoiselle?
No, I didn't. No.
My mom worked for Mademoiselle Magazine, but she's now in her 80s, but she had as her intern, Sylvia Plath.
Oh my gosh.
You know, who interned at Mademoiselle. And so that was, let's see, like the late 60s.
And what did she do? What did your mom do?
She was an editor and a writer. I mean, she was young, you know, working in publishing, and she also worked with Linda McCartney before she was Linda McCartney. She was just this awkward girl, Linda. She married Paul McCartney.
Linda married Paul, and had a line of clothes, and then did this.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my God, that's so cool. That's so cool. I think you should volunteer to meet with local book clubs at swimming hole areas in Austin. I think that'd be so cool.
That is such a great idea.
If anybody's not in a book club, you will do spontaneous book clubs on the Greenbelt at different nights, and people come and meet you. That'd be fun.
I love it. Yes. And we can go swimming if it gets too hot, because it's starting to get hot here. I love that idea.
My husband said it was like 97 in San Antonio this week. He was going crazy. He said, it's so warm. So warm.
Yeah.
So what was your writing process like? Did you write it straight? Did you write one character? Because you go back and forth from points of view, and that's a lot going on.
Well, I'm in the lucky position now where I usually sell off 50 pages. Like I've sold my next two books already, and I have 50 pages and then the outline. So I'll have all these index cards and the outline figure out. Of course, it's going to change, but I do not write sequentially. I kind of, you know, I sit down and I say, this is the next scene, but then I'll look at maybe the next 30 scenes and pick which I really want to write. And then I kind of piece it all together. It's as complicated as humanly possible. And in this case, I was going to a relative's house to work because all my kids were home. So it was a wonderful escape to just go off and write about these characters. And at one point, I wasn't sure what was going on with the mystery. And so my friend Leah Stewart, who I talked to about, she's another novelist, she said, just write about the women's lives and you'll come back to the mystery. So that's when I started getting really into their backstories and just figuring out who they were. Mm-hmm. I write in this circuitous way that is incomprehensible to anyone but me. It's actually incomprehensible to me.
It's like, how do I do this?
I have the index cards and I have them in order, and then I'll lay them out and pick one every day and then rearrange them and put in new index cards. So it is this complete, it seems like a plan every morning, and then I get it all messed up and then I'll figure it out again.
You have to do it again. I did want to bring up one other thing too. The Annette is an American Party. This was so much fun to read. Everything that they'd done for this party where something else happens. But I was just laughing so hard at everything was red, white, and blue. Everybody had to do this. It was just, they were over the top moments that I just loved.
Yes, well, thank you. And actually, I've had quite a few friends become American citizens. Mm. Because there are a lot of, you can get through college and even married and pretty old before you decide you want American citizenship. And so I've had friends and they'll have a party .
This was a very good party. This is a good party plan if anybody needs it. This is
They just did a cute book club guide with recipes for the margaritas for these famous nachos from Matt's El Rancho down the street from me and all the delicious food.
Yeah, it sounds great. We'll have to link out to that too. We'll have to link that. Was writing this different from the Jet Setters? Was it like more?
Oh, yeah.
That was complicated though too.
It's actually much easier for me to do a plot. For me to have a dead body and solve the crime is much easier. The Jet Setters was so hard for me because it's really just these characters changing. And there was no like clue, and then we need to move the plot along in this way. So that was really hard. The life parts, I knew the plot. I knew where it was going to go. Things changed along the way. And the climactic scene was a real problem. So the galley is different from the hardcover book because I had not figured it out. And I sent it in and they went to galley before I was ready. And so I said, no, I'm changing it. And they said, well, the galleys are printed. And I said, no. And so I changed the ending. And the hardcover has a different ending.
Well, I'm glad I read the hardcover then.
Me too, because I think I figured it out, but it was, I wrote 100 different scenes. I couldn't figure, because for a thriller, you want a high, a cinematic type of scene. And so I had people falling off balconies into pools and like all kinds of things, but I like the way it worked out in the underground bunker.
Was the title always the lifeguards? Was that your working title? That was always the life title.
Yes. And I had sold this book before the Jet Setters became a Reese pick. So it was just sort of, I was going to do a non-thriller about characters on a cruise ship. And then I don't know where I come up with these ideas, honestly.
You actually interviewed Miranda for her book, for the paper at Palace, right? Yes. I remember because it was on recent, like I really wanted to see that interview and like I somehow missed it. And then it was like, where is it? You know, but
it was so fun. And, you know, the ending of her book inspired the ending of mine because I thought, ooh, you can have a kind of questionable, exciting ending. And yes. That's what she does. And everybody in the Reese's book chat, all the questions were like, who does she pick? Who does she pick? And she said, I'm not going to answer it. But then she reads it a certain way to give you the answer.
Yes. My book club read it. Two people saw it one way, six saw it the other way. It was really crazy.
Isn't that amazing? I saw it one way, but disagreed with her choice.
Well, I said, just read the last three pages aloud. Yep. We're going to see what the answer is. But
you're right.
Interviewing her for one of our Bookachino Live book clubs in a couple of weeks.
Oh, fun. She's wonderful.
And I said, we will discuss. I interviewed her when the book first came out, but it's one of those ones that book clubs are really rabid about talking about. Yeah. And I said, okay, let's do that. And yes, we will discuss the ending, you know?
It's and really she's fun. Adapting it, I think, for the TV series.
Yes. So that's yes. So cool. She was writing it when I talked to her. So that's what she was doing. This is very cinematic. This one's very cinematic. Both of the Jet Setters.
Thank you. Yeah, it's out now. We're talking to a few different people. I don't know what'll happen yet. Nothing's happened yet. Nothing solid.
Just remember, what was I saying? White Lotus. Like, you know, there's another comp. White Lotus.
Love it. I love that.
Fun. White Lotus. You know, and the cover, which is a perfect pairing with the Jet Setters. Was this the first cover you saw or did they play around?
No. There were many different covers. And I was inspired by the Jet Setters German cover has a woman diving. And so I said, what about this? And they started with that, but then came up with, at first it didn't look like a Barton, like a green belt. It looked more like a swimming pool. And I said, well, it's the green belt. So they changed that. And then the colors changed and they had three women on these, which was just like the Jet Setters.
Right.
So I said, let's mix it up a little bit. So we did.
I really love it.
It's a great designer. I love the designer and I love the color.
That's why I pulled it off the shelf was the cover. It was like my pull away. I was like,
good. Oh, I'm so glad. That's the goal.
It was the cover. So how about the audiobook? You've got this ensemble cast. You've got Hilary Huber, Marin Al, Ireland, Kirby Hayborn, and Carissa Vacker. What made them decide to do this? Like
this
ensemble.
Project?
This ensemble.
I had to pick who I wanted. They sent me a lot of actors' audio, and I picked the ones I wanted. And it was hard to pick Liza because I really wanted her to be empathetic and, you know, she's kind of nervous, but also gutsy. And so, but this actress is perfect. And I've just been listening to the audiobook. It's really strange.
I'm just going to ask you, have you been listening?
I normally don't because none of my books are kid friendly and I'm always in the car with kids. But I've started walking around the neighborhood and listening. And it is funny. I mean, everyone in the neighborhood knows about the book. Right. So I'm kind of normally in, you know, like Adidas tracksuits, like with a hat, and I don't really chat. But now people, like at the Girl Scout camp out, people are coming up to me, like, are you Amanda Ward? You know, I can't wait to read the book in our neighborhood. It's because, you know, the whole Reese thing happened and I never saw anyone. Mm-mm. And it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is. Crazy. It's like, oh yeah, this happens. And now, you know, da da da. So what is next for you? What is next?
So the next novel is called The Peacocks, and it's about a family named The Peacocks. And one of the daughters had a tragedy and has been single for a really long time. And she falls in love and decides to get married in Costa Rica at a jungle resort. And her entire dysfunctional family comes along. And that I'm very excited about. So I have not been back to Costa Rica since I had that idea. But I really hope to go soon.
Well, it would be a business expense. So I think you should go soon.
That's right. Expense. Yes. And it has to be in the middle of nowhere. So they're kind of trapped together. And I'm really excited about it. It's fun and funny. She's a children's librarian and I just like her.
So when is that? Next year or the following year? When do you think?
I am due to hand it in at the end of next summer.
Okay. Okay.
So it won't be for a while.
For a while. Well, we look forward to it because we've heard of the
Thank
Peacock
you.
Already, everybody, because I'm so ready. I just so enjoyed this book. I'm going to tell people, just pick it up and read it because it's got that thriller kind of a feeling to it, but it's also got the moms. There's so much going on in this book. Book clubs, there is so much to talk about. So much. Rip through this and like, you know, then go have a chat. So, man,
thank you so much. What a thrill to be here again. And next time, let's do it IRL.
Just figure that out. I'll come down to Austin.
That would be wonderful. I'd love to see you. I can still make a good margarita.
There you go. You're on.
Okay. Yeah. Jody Picot and I had margaritas last time she was here.
That's like the perfect. And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time, margaritas or not.
Yeah.
Book Reporter Talks To. And remember, you can subscribe by following us on our YouTube channel or listening wherever podcasts are. So thanks so much for joining us. Thanks again, Amanda.
Thank you.
Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Lifeguards by Amanda Eyre Ward, narrated by the ensemble cast of Hilary Huber, Marin at Ireland, Kirby Hayborn, and Carissa Vacker, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Random House Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The Lifeguards, narrated by the ensemble cast of Hilary Huber, Marin Ireland, Kirby Hayborn, and Carissa Vacker, courtesy of Random House Audio.
Our boys were lifeguards, we told ourselves, and were surely safe. Weren't they safe? They knew CPR, had shown us their fanny packs filled with Band-Aids and plastic breathing tubes. Xavier, Bobcat, and Charlie, my son, had taken the course together, weekend mornings at Barton Springs. We'd dropped them off at dawn, the Texas sun just starting to climb above the horizon, making the surface of the spring-fed swimming hole flash red and orange. We'd said we'd walk Lady Bird Lake together, or we'd stand up paddleboard or grab coffee. Instead, we smiled as we dropped the boys, went home to the adult lives we'd begun to create again now that our children were 15. I was ghostwriting a cookbook, Annette was working at Hola Amigos daycare, and Whitney had become an Austin real estate titan. Now that we no longer had endless summer days with elementary schoolers underfoot, it was harder to connect. But our friendship was unbreakable, as safe as the neighborhood where we'd raised our sweet little kids. Or so we thought. By the end of the summer, one of us would be gone. Where are they? I said, glancing at my watch. I liked wearing a thin gold watch I'd bought at an antiques store. Sometimes I told people it had been my mother's, conjuring an old money family that didn't exist. Oh, how I loved the idea of a mother who'd wear such an elegant timepiece on a slim wrist. My actual mother, in contrast, had a tattoo of a snake on her hand. It was 11 o'clock p.m., which was definitely too late. Riding their bikes around the neighborhood, they said Annette. Her son, Bobcat, was rail thin and 6'3", a reluctant ninth grade basketball star. Despite Bobcat insisting he just wanted to build computers in his room, Annette's husband forced their son to keep playing. During the last game of the season, an opponent elbowed Bobcat hard in the soft place underneath his ribcage. It was awful to see Bobcat's face crumple in pain, but he only glanced toward the stands at his father and didn't make a sound. When my son, Charlie, went over his mountain bike handles on a trail and cut his forehead, I felt his pain viscerally. I could scarcely watch him pedal away, even now that he wore the most expensive safety equipment available, a $200 full-face helmet, padded bike shorts, neck brace, wrist, elbow, and knee pads, and a back protector made of VPD, whatever that was. Despite Charlie's complaints, I'd bought all the items at Dick's Sporting Goods on layaway. The sign above the gear was a siren call. You can buy the feeling of safety. Sure, the other kids made fun of him with his braces and helmets, but I'd rather my son be embarrassed than dead. It was possible, as Charlie had suggested gently, that I had anxiety issues. Maybe, as he'd said, I should use our money to talk to someone. but you couldn't see a therapist on layaway, now could you? I'd handle my brain when I'd somehow gotten Charlie to college without any major bodily damage. Splurging on things that made me feel more secure was working for me, so I ignored Charlie's complaints and insinuations and loved him hard and bought him safety equipment. Annette went to every game wearing Austin High colors from head to toe. She had platinum blonde hair and bronze skin, wide brown eyes. She carefully sculpted her thick eyebrows into perfect arches, accented her high cheekbones and naturally plump lips with drugstore makeup, and wore expensive jewelry at all times. When Lewis, who had been too short to play basketball himself, led cheers for Bobcat from the stands and stomped his feet on the bleachers, tried to start the wave and was largely ignored, Annette stood by his side. We all loved Lewis, his childlike enthusiasm, but Annette knew, as we all did, that Bobcat played only to please his father, but really came alive when explaining the best graphics card for his latest home-built PC. Lewis wanted his son to be the athlete he'd dreamed of becoming himself. He couldn't fathom a person with physical gifts not wanting to use them. I thought it was just a matter of time before Bobcat either became who he was meant to be or stopped trying. Did Annette defend her son behind closed doors? Or was marriage about acquiescence, silencing yourself in the name of marital harmony?